I think.
Yeah. Lisa really wanted to be here, but she taught until 10:30 last night. Couldn't come with me. I got here at midnight as it was.
Oh my God. Oh, how annoying.
Yeah, right.
Yes, I do.
We do.
Well, then let's get out of the way.
Okay.
No further need to wait.
Who needs an audience? We have the presenters.
Yeah, right. All right. If I may have your attention. The first afternoon panel is entitled, Looking Past the Definition of Disability, How Effective Are the ADA's Affirmative Requirements in Achieving Equality for People with Disabilities? And to present these thoughts on these items, we have Hai Feldblum, Professor of Law, Georgetown University Law Center, and we have commentators, Dan Goldstein, partner Brown, Goldstein, and Levy, and then we have Douglas Cruz, who is a professor of human resource management, labor studies and employment relations, Rutgers University School of Management and Labor Relations. And Hai Feldblum served as one of the lead lawyers responsible for negotiating the Americans with Disabilities Act while working at the AIDS Project of the American Civil Liberties Union. Currently, Professor Feldblum and her Federal Rehabilitation Clinic staff and students represent the Epilepsy Foundation in its work to advance the ADA Restoration Act of 2007. She served as co-counsel in the Supreme Court case of Chevron versus Akazabal in 2002 and filed amicus briefs in a number of Supreme Court cases dealing with disability and gay rights. Dan Goldstein, this is the bio he wrote. I've played poker with Dan Goldstein, so I can give you the details. Has been a disability rights lawyer for the last two decades. He has represented the National Federation of the Blind and Blind Individuals in cases that have resulted in an agreement to make the next version of AOL accessible to the blind, required a number of websites to alter their design to make them usable by blind people. One of them was the IRS. I just love suing the IRS. And helped make voice prompt ATMs more widely accessible. As a matter of fact, he got something like 28,000 of them to be usable by blind people. Currently, Mr. Goldstein is engaged in class action litigation against Target Corporation over the inaccessibility of Target's website. And besides, he's a very good poker player. Douglas Cruz conducts economic studies on disability, profit sharing, employee ownership, pensions, and wage differentials. Professor Cruz is a research associate with the National Bureau of Economic Research and was appointed to the President's Committee on Employment of People with Disabilities. It is a pleasure to have all of you on this panel. I look forward to what you are about to present. We will start with Professor Feldblum.
Thank you. And for all of you folks who want to know how Mario Achazabal pronounced his last name, that was it, Achazabal. Achazabal. And it really was, most of the time, my involvement with Supreme Court cases has been only doing amicus briefs. But in that case, the person who was the lawyer from California actually contacted me because unlike most lawyers who, when they get the chance to go to the Supreme Court, just want to do it all by themselves, which therefore sometimes gets us some of the cases we get, he actually wanted to reach out to some disability law experts. Now, that doesn't mean you end up winning the case. We lost it 9-0, that's another story as to why and how. Okay, number one, I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. Lots of people often start their comments that way, thank you for the opportunity for being here. I almost never do. Like, I'm just so ready to get into my remarks, and I spend most of my time saying no to things, right? So I never usually say that, but I have to say that for me today, to be at the first conference that is named in honor of Professor Ten Broeck is really an incredible honor. And I feel as if I wish that video could be shown in every law school across this country because, yes, don't you think? Because, I mean, for those people who do constitutional law, you know, Tenbrook's name is just central. Most of those people, I think, have no clue that he was blind, you know. And so to actually convey to law students the capacity, the intellectual capacity, just as one little, you know, it's like imagine a rock and you got to get the water against the rock to counter the myths and stereotypes about people who are blind. You know, that's a lot of water down a rock. You got to go. But showing that video could be one trickle of water down that rock in terms of changing people's minds. And I'm also now making a mental note to myself, even though I do come from New York City, to speak slower. Save the typing hands. Okay. About 10 months ago, I think it was about 10 months ago, when I was asked to come up with a title and a paper name for this, I came up with this title of Beyond the Definition of Disability, How Effective Are the ADA's Affirmative Requirements in Achieving Equality for People with Disabilities? Now, this was a very intentional, optimistic title, right? Because I figured, oh, by April 2008, we'll be done with the negotiation on the ADA Restoration Act. It'll be sailing through the House, you know. Okay, well, not exactly, but it is absolutely moving. And I do have to say that the last 2 months in which I would have put some time into writing a paper that I could have then sent to the commentators, so like the other commentators, they would have actually had a full paper. Instead, they have contributed to the ADA Restoration Act by not getting a paper from me because that's what I've been doing for the last 2 months is the negotiation on that. So and I did send them something. And we had a great conversation yesterday. So you guys are going to get a great panel, I'm sure. But just to let you know that I've put them at a bit of a disadvantage. But what I wanted to talk about then, and we'll still talk about now, is this question of assuming one got past the problem of establishing that one is a person with a disability, how effective are the affirmative requirements that are in the ADA designed to achieve equality for people with disabilities? And are there things, ways that we should think about those affirmative requirements differently? And as you will see at the end of my comments, the scope of the definition of disability is, in fact, relevant to this question. So it's beyond the definition of disability, but you'll see it will wrap back around to the definition. Okay, in terms of the question, when I ask the question, how effective are the ADA's affirmative requirements, first let me say clearly what I mean by the affirmative requirements of the ADA. For Title I, if you're an employee, right, what the ADA says is you have the right not only to have your disability ignored, if your disability will have no relevance to the job, right, to have your disability ignored, but you also have the right to have your disability affirmatively taken into account if you need a reasonable accommodation in order to perform the job you are being asked to perform. Now, as you heard today at lunch, if the job you're being asked to perform is to write 12 letters during the week, the reasonable accommodation is not to reduce that standard, right? The reasonable accommodation is to make sure that you get whatever it is you need that your disability would otherwise limit you from in order to do that job, whether it's a device or some other change, okay? So in employment, the affirmative obligation of a reasonable accommodation has three separate components. It has the component of providing some sort of device, right, that in case you have, let's say, a hearing or vision impairment, some sort of device. It includes making changes in terms of physical access. If what the reason you can't do the job is because there are two steps up to the office. And it includes changes, modifications to policies and practices that govern that workplace. So it's three separate components under the concept of reasonable accommodation with the same defense for the employer for any of those three. That is, it's an undue hardship. And for modifying of policies, that includes that it would fundamentally alter the nature of the policy. In the titles of the ADA that apply to people with disabilities as customers, clients, visitors, spectators, conference goers, okay, with regard to that, there are also the affirmative, there's also the core requirement of if all you need is for your disability to be ignored, we don't let people with cerebral palsy in here, or we don't let people with HIV/AIDS in here, right? The law says the disability shall be ignored, but it also has this set of affirmative requirements. And in Title III of the ADA, the public accommodations title, the same three conceptual components that are packed together under reasonable accommodation and employment are separated out with three different provisions. So there's the provision of auxiliary aids and services, which is devices essentially for people with vision or hearing impairments, and that has the defense of undue burden, which is the equivalent to undue hardship in employment. Second, there's a requirement that you must modify policies or procedures unless it would fundamentally alter the nature of the process. And then for physical access, that is pulled out separately because there are three separate levels of responsibility based on whether the building is existing right now, whether you're retrofitting it, or whether you're building new. Okay, so conceptually, though, in both dealing with people with disabilities as employees or dealing with people with disabilities as customers, clients, visitors, conference goers, there's a requirement that you ignore the disability, and there's also a requirement that you take the disability into account by making certain affirmative changes if that's necessary for the person to do the job, enjoy the goods or service. And by the way, an overlay in all of this, in certainly in public accommodations, is the affirmative obligation of integration. All right, so when we ask the question, how effective are the ADA's affirmative requirements in achieving equality for people with disabilities, I think we are or should be asking three separate questions. One, how effective are the requirements in the law right now that I've just described? B, two, how do we ensure the continued effectiveness of these requirements as we try to restore a broad definition of disability? How do we maintain the effectiveness of these requirements to the extent they have been effective? And three, are some of the goals that we are trying to achieve through these affirmative requirements within an anti-discrimination law actually better achieved not through an anti-discrimination law, but rather directly by having the government require the activities and outcomes that we want? Okay, that's the third question. Okay, so first, I want to talk about how conceptually it makes sense. It makes sense conceptually for an anti-discrimination law to include these types of affirmative obligations. But when we think about these requirements, I think it's important that we see these requirements, when we see them in action, when we see a sign language interpreter standing here, or we see the words on a screen, or when we see a particular device that someone is using that has been supplied to them by an employer, that we see those as examples of equality minus, not examples of equality plus. Okay. Often what people think, if they think, oh my God, I have to put a ramp now, I have to do something special over these steps, or I have to get a sign language interpreter, I have to do something special for this person, right? So it feels to the person providing the affirmative change like a special right. It feels like equality plus. Okay. I think we have to very clearly understand it, conceptualize it, educate the society to realize that these are examples of equality minus. And here's why. None of this is going to be new to any of you, but here's why in terms of a visual and a concept. And it comes directly from Ten Brooks' conceptual analysis of equal rights, directly. In a piece that I wrote a few years ago called Rectifying the Tilt, Equality Lessons from Religion, Disability, sexual orientation, and transgender. I said the following. Society is set up with a certain set of background norms that means that some people are standing upright and other people are on a tilt because of that background norm. Okay, so the background norm is we build some buildings with grand staircases. So anyone who can walk up those staircases is, in this visual, standing upright, doesn't even notice anything. Someone who's using a wheelchair is on a tilt, you know, cannot get into the building. Or we have a society where we grow up learning English, and just English. We don't grow up in a society where we learn English and sign language at the same time. I mean, we could, right? We grow up in a society where we have materials that are all on paper. They're not materials that also speak to us, right? I mean, we could now, technologically, right? So we're making certain decisions as a society as to what the background norm will look like. And so there are people who are standing upright because they work fine with that background norm. Now, the concept of non-discrimination, from my perspective, which certainly doesn't mean treating people equally when if you treat them equally, they can't access the same things. It means treating people as equals, as people with full dignity, right? So the concept of non-discrimination would mean that as soon as we became aware as a society that one of our background norms was keeping out a sector of the community, we would change the background norm so that everyone could stand upright. Now, that is the concept behind saying that every new building that gets built has to be built in an accessible manner. And then everyone is standing upright, both the person who can walk up the stairs as well as the person who rolls up the ramp. And it's in a much more integrated fashion. In fact, as you'll hear in some of the comments, sometimes we can figure things out when we're changing that background norm that actually makes it better for everybody. When you heard that comment on the curb cuts, but it can go across a range of areas. So a form of non-discrimination, from my perspective, should be this sense on the part of society, if it can, to change that background norm. Now, sometimes it just can't. Like, no matter what, we're not going to have a society in which everyone's going to learn sign language at the same time that they learn English. It's not going to happen. We're not, you know. So then if you have a sign language interpreter for that person, in my mind, what you're doing then is you're rectifying the tilt just under that one person for that one moment. But that's why it's clearly an example of equality minus, because it's a situation where society has decided it is too costly or less feasible to make the change in the background norm that would let everybody stand upright. You know, I'd be sitting doing here sign language because that's how we would all have grown up. And someone who was deaf, it just would be completely integrated. So a reasonable accommodation, rectifying the tilt under that one person, is an acknowledgement on the part of society that it has chosen not to fix the background norm. And sometimes that makes sense. Sometimes that makes sense. But let's be clear with society that it has an obligation to critique, to understand what are the background norms that are causing some people to stand upright and others on a tilt. Okay. Now, after I wrote that piece, Rectifying the Tilt, one of the main questions I got was, well, you know, everyone is on a tilt for some reason. You know, what could the boundaries be? How could we possibly be trying, you know, this is crazy. Well, you know, I think there are various answers to that question. And one is that usually the people who are on the tilt tend to be either a minority in terms of numbers or minority in a sense of power to change things. Because otherwise, honey, the norm would have been changed. We'd all be standing upright. So that's one way. But another way to think about it is this. And this now wraps to the second piece that I will say in these comments before opening to the comments. Sometimes, actually, a lot of people are on a tilt for a particular reason, like more than a majority of people. But the best way to deal with rectifying that tilt is not necessarily through use of an anti-discrimination law. And so what I want to do is focus just on the issue of employment and workplace schedules. And now you'll see how it'll wrap up into the definition of disability. The way we envision, remember I said there are three components to reasonable accommodation. One is modification of policies and practices. One subcomponent of policies and practices are workplace schedules. So, for example, if you have diabetes, you should be able to get a break if you need a break in order to check your insulin and get some food. Or if you have a type of disability, you have a mental illness, you have something that requires you to be able to leave for a set time each week, you should be able to get that. If telecommuting would work for you, you should be able to get that. We considered all of that under reasonable accommodation as modification of policies and practices. Now, as you heard earlier, we have very few cases under reasonable accommodation because everyone keeps getting thrown out right at the get-go of a they're not a person with a disability. But of the cases we have dealing with workplace scheduling, the cases are mixed. And some courts have just not at all wanted to put any burden on employers, and they've just said, well, attendance is an essential job function. You know, so forget about getting any time off or any, you know. While others have been more interested in pushing the norm, as I said, the whole concept of reasonable accommodation to me is a stop, think, and justify obligation on the part of the employer. And some courts, in terms of workplace scheduling, have forced that to the employer. You have to stop, think, and justify, really, can this person, in fact, do this job at home? You know, you've let other people telecommute, and now this person wants to telecommute because of his or her disability. So the case law has been mixed. The question, though, but it is a very complicated issue about time off from work because people need short-term time off if they get sick or their kid gets sick. They need sometimes extended time off. That time off needs to be paid under the ADA. You don't get any guarantee for paid leave. These are complicated issues around leave economically. They're complicated issues. And in terms of flexible work arrangements, you really want an interactive process between the employee and the employer about how to make these flexible schedules work. If the definition of disability is too broad, okay, so that everybody gets to ask for that flexible schedule or, you know, this time off, I think my fear is that you could have courts cutting back even more on what is going to be a legitimate reasonable accommodation. I mean, they already have a tendency not to want to mess with employers. Okay? So that could be that there's a little bit more of a tendency if it looks like too many people can ask for the reasonable accommodation. And secondly, some of these, because they are economically difficult, the best way to deal with it maybe by having the government be involved in a more affirmative way in terms of helping with payment of paid leave, et cetera. And again, courts don't have the ability to mandate that, so they might just shy away from the whole area. So that's difficult if the definition is too broad. On the other hand, if you've been discriminated against because of some impairment, you want to make sure that you don't have to demonstrate any level of severity. You know, if you've been discriminated against because of that impairment, you should be able to bring a civil rights claim. So there are these two separate components, and I do believe that one way to potentially address it is to make sure that there's a strong component in the law that allows you to bring a claim if you can show any nexus between the discriminatory action and your impairment. You know, and then there's the severity of your impairment is irrelevant versus a situation where there are going to be these affirmative obligations that you're going to be asking of the employer. Now, it's not always easy to figure that out, but I think conceptually that's where we should be heading. Now, does that mean, let's assume that that's where we go, that we just drop the effort to, let's say, get time off or flexible scheduling for people with a whole range of impairments? Not at all, from my perspective. The question just becomes, do you want to try to do that through a non-discrimination statute targeted to a subset of people, and it would be people with all types of medical conditions and people with caregiving responsibilities? Those would be your subset. Do you want to do it that way and say this is the accommodation to give to this subset? Or do you want to just say as a labor standard, as a way of doing business in this country, here's what you need, here's what a decent job in this country means. And it has the allowance for time off that is paid. And it has a incentive for employers to engage in flexible work arrangement conversations. My belief on that, I think we should be looking at the labor standard. Because to me, that's like changing the background norm in a much more integrated fashion. Because what if you want to take that time off to, you know, do something else? You know, learn how to fly an airplane. I don't know. You know, but the fact is, if we can make the jobs more flexible, I believe that it will help everyone who needs that, whether it's because of a disability, caregiving, or anything else. So I think one of the brilliant concepts that we from disability gave to the world was the universal design concept in architecture, right? Which is, let's just look at the background norm. Let's see if we can change this so that everybody can actually come in, participate, and live in the world the way that Professor Tenbruck said. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Feldblum. I also appreciate having at least one chance to learn how to pronounce that fancy name there. I hope I remember. I've been thinking of practicing, but I'll wait till later. The first commentator on this topic is a man whose legal capacity I've come to know very well, and this is Dan Goldstein. We have worked with him for now well over 20 years, and he has been a tremendous assistant and a person who has carried the work of disability law all over the United States, and now and then he has encouraged people in other countries to know about it. So here's Dan Goldstein.
Fact that was not covered in the video about Dr. Tenbruck is that he taught legal writing at the University of Chicago in 1940 and 1941, taught my father legal writing. And that is a partial but undoubtedly not complete explanation of why my father's writing is so much more lucid and coherent and eloquent than I can hope to aspire to. But I wanted to share that small connection. In looking at how effective the ADA's affirmative requirements, I would like to change it to how effective can they be in achieving equality. I'd like to advocate that today we look at that question not as civil rights lawyers, but as rapacious private practitioners or corporate lawyers. That is to say, what if we looked at how to make it work, looking at what the economics of discrimination and the economics of equality are, and could that guide us some in the agenda, at least in the Title III area, the public accommodations area? This proposal starts with what Professor Feldblum was talking about, which was changing the background norm. We have the opportunity, for example, to be advocating to those who have public accommodations that if they change it for everybody, not just for a disability, they can improve it for everyone. I'll give you an example. You've all seen the new Amazon Kindle, or you've seen it on the Amazon website. It is a portable wireless reader. You can download books in a matter of minutes and then read them on the Kindle. That is an inaccessible device because there is no audible component. On the other hand, if a businessman could go from reading what he needs for his meeting on his Kindle to hopping in the car for the 50-mile drive to his meeting to switching it over to audio, it would be a better, more attractive product. And if you then could convince the elementary schools that here is the greatest thing in the world for LD kids because they can both see the print they need to learn to read while they hear it, then Amazon, you get to capture the market that Apple's going after, the pediatric market, get them hooked on iPods at age 5, you've got a better product for the world. So one of the things we could do is say, okay, for at least the foreseeable future, unless, Chai, you work a miracle with the Restoration Act, we're not going to have damages in Title III, but we have to find where the money is. We have to follow the money. So one thing is to take seriously that those accommodations that can benefit particular groups can also benefit everyone. How does that spin out elsewhere? Well, once we could get the ATM industry to understand that it costs them about 50 cents to put in the earphone receptacle on the ATM at the manufacturing level, and that you could buy 50 sound cards for $5 and thereby make every machine susceptible, ATM machine coming out on the line, susceptible to being voice guided, that tips the balance. Because then all you're talking about is a small cost for increasing your market share. And that's why we're going to win this battle on websites fairly quickly. I mean, we're going to have problems because Web 2.0 is going to come out. It's going to create a whole new set of technical challenges. But we're ultimately going to win the battle on websites more easily than we've won other battles, because the blind are a market share that will use the web commercially, and the cost of making websites accessible is small compared to the cost or rather to the benefit of web accessibility. So that's one approach, I think, to how we get further along in accessibility. But I think there is another economic motivation, and it goes beyond the ADA here, but one we have, as a community, have overlooked and not used, and that's Section 508. Because if you can't sell to the government, you're losing out to a major customer. And at this point, most of the governmental agencies aren't even bothering to follow 508, and the people who sell to government agencies aren't even bothering to do the certifications, because we as a community have not been using this incredibly valuable tool. But let me suggest to you that the way we can really make it a valuable tool is we can find a company that is accessible at the same time that we are going after the one that isn't. For example, word is the BlackBerry is going to be accessible fairly shortly. Then one can do FOIA requests and look to see which government agencies are buying inaccessible phones, which maybe the iPhone. And when the government agency tries to say, well, there is no equivalent product, we can say, oh, yes, there is. And point to that. So I think we can do these things, and it will help change not only those specific instances, but the culture change that we need to have take place. Because it really will be integration in the sense that we'll be more integrated into the economics of the broader system. I mentioned one or two other thoughts that just in terms of what we can do to change, because once Laura talked about, you know, how do we plan an overall program, I got thinking in that direction. We have started recruiting attorneys general offices as co-plaintiffs to add legitimacy, or rather to convey the legitimacy we already have. And it's a dangerous way to go, because there's always the risk they'll wander off the reservation and go with the wrong results and push with the wrong things. So you have to cultivate relationships very carefully. But I keep thinking about the change in culture about tobacco that came when the Association of Attorneys Generals brought an action as a group. And at least for now, I don't think any of us want to go to the Department of Justice for anything. So there is the potential, I think, if we develop relationships with not one but a number of attorneys general, so that at least they know us, we know them, we have confidence they're going to do the right thing, that there may be the opportunity for a similar case to go forward and put us on the map as legitimate. So we need better tools, we need stronger tools, but we also need to use the tools we have, and these are some of my thoughts on what we could do.
Thank you, Daniel.
And I don't draw it inside straight, sir.
He will draw to a pink floofy now and then. Douglas Cruz, professor of human resource management, labor studies and employment from Rutgers University. Professor Cruz?
Certainly pleased to be here. Unlike a lot of the presenters, I'm not a lawyer. I'm actually an economist. Several years ago, I was preparing to make a presentation at an academic conference about some of my disability research, and I asked a colleague of mine, who happens to be a psychologist, if I should mention at the beginning of my talk my own disability. And he said, absolutely, without a doubt, you should not hesitate to admit that you are, in fact, an economist. Thanks, Angela. That's not the disability I was thinking about, but thanks for the vote of support there. Let me just add a few comments to the discussion. I do want to note that I'm glad to hear that I was contributing to the passage of the ADA Restoration Act by the simple act of not receiving a paper. and I'm glad to make similar efforts in the future. Of course, I'm willing to do more than that. I want to make just a few comments here, some of which tie into Kai's emphasis on the importance of flexible work arrangements. There's both good news and bad news in current labor market trends for people with disabilities. Let me start with the bad news. The recent trends in employment of people with disabilities are pretty stagnant. There's been a lot of controversy over how to measure disability and how to assess the role of the ADA in employment trends. Some early research actually found drops in employment of people with disabilities following the ADA, and they claimed that this showed the ADA's accommodation mandate scared employers into not hiring people with disabilities. Some closer examination of this, however, revealed a more complex story in which the employment trends depend on the disability measure being used. One of these studies makes a pretty good case that there may have been a brief drop-off in hiring of people with disabilities in 1 or 2 years after the ADA was implemented in some states, but that effect quickly dissipated. The problem is that by almost all measures, the employment of people with disabilities has not gone up over the past 20 years, and it appears that the main culprit is the expansion of the disability income system, particularly SSDI, with its many disincentives for employment. Another bit of bad news is occupational projections. Working on a project in conjunction with Peter Blank and the government grant here, looking at matching up the Bureau of Labor Statistics occupational projections to the employment of people with disabilities, it turns out that workers with disabilities are underrepresented in the fastest growing occupations, jobs like network systems analysts and computer programmers, and they're overrepresented in the occupations with the fastest rate of decline, blue-collar jobs, textile machine operators, jobs like that. And this is looking at 10-year projections, if there's no change in disability prevalence across occupations, people with disabilities will lag in job growth, about 86,000 fewer jobs than if they were equally represented across occupations. Actually, one interesting thing about that, people with disabilities are overrepresented in one of the fastest-growing occupations, which is home health aides. Home health aides is a fast-growing occupation, driven in part, as we know, by the aging of the population and increasing rates of disability. Well, it turns out that people with disabilities themselves are more likely more likely than in other occupations to be home health aides. About 1 out of 7 of home health aides themselves have a disabling condition. So that's the bad news. There is also good news, however. One bit of good news is the growing importance of computers and new information technologies. These technologies can have special benefits for people with disabilities, as we all know, helping compensate for physical or sensory impairments, screen readers, voice recognition systems, and so forth, and substantially increasing the productivity of many workers with disabilities. In early research, Alan Kruger at Princeton and I found that people with computer skills at the time of a spinal cord injury had a faster return to work and computer use especially enhanced earnings among people with spinal cord injuries. In fact, the really interesting thing there was that computer use seemed to eliminate the disability earnings gap. There's a disability earnings gap among non-users of computers. The people with disabilities who didn't use a computer had very low earnings, but computer use seemed to even that out. So that's one bit of good news, that there's growing use of those. Another bit is the increased use of telecommuting and flexible work arrangements. New information technologies have made home-based work more productive, which can have special benefits for people with disabilities, particularly those with transportation problems or medical concerns that require them to be close to home. In addition, there's been growing interest in other types of flexible work arrangements that can help accommodate the needs of people with disabilities, such as job sharing, temporary agency employment. People with disabilities do seem to be generally in jobs allowing greater flexibility. The recent data show that compared to workers without disabilities, workers with disabilities are about 40 to 50% more likely to be doing home-based work for pay, about 50% more likely to be doing part-time work, twice as likely to be in flexible contingent jobs, temp jobs, on-call jobs, and jobs like that. They are, however, and this is surprising to me, they're no more likely to have flexible working hours. About one-third, or 32%, of workers with disabilities can choose when to begin and end work, which is the same as for workers without disabilities. It's clear that workers with disabilities should have full access to standard full-time jobs, not just the temp part-time jobs and so forth, but the growth of several types of flexible and contingent jobs is promising for enhancing employment of people with disabilities, of many people. Finally, there's good news in the growing attention to workplace diversity. Most large corporations today have diversity programs, and a growing number are including disability as one of the criteria for a diverse workforce. Not enough, but more and more are including that. Overall, that good news and bad news presents a mixed picture for the employment of people with disabilities. Occupational trends are obviously worrisome, but with appropriate employer and government policies, people with disabilities should be able to move into the fastest growing occupations. What are those policies? We explored those in a report that was released by the National Council on Disability this past October. I coordinated a research team with colleagues from Rutgers and Syracuse universities, including Peter, the University of Iowa, and the Just One Break organization. There's been a lot of attention over the past decade to the supply side of the labor market, looking at things like education and training gaps and disincentives from disability income, SSDI, and so forth. A major contribution of the report is that the demand side has a role to play as well. The companies can adopt best practices to increase recruiting, training, promotion, retention of people with disabilities. As many employers stress, it makes good business sense. People with disabilities represent a valuable pool of human resources to help fill the projected labor shortages in the next decades as we baby boomers start retiring. We received advice and guidance from a business advisory committee containing representatives from 25 leading U.S. companies and an expert advisory panel. We had their advice on a variety of topics for issue briefs, which are designed to be short, standalone summaries of what we do and don't know in a particular area, which can easily be read by a wide range of people. We chose 12 topics, 7 topics on employment policies and practices, recruitment retention, employee development, work-life balance and alternative work arrangements, reasonable accommodations, corporate culture, universal design, and self-employment, and an additional 5 topics on other dimensions affecting employment, transportation, healthcare, education, housing and livable communities, and long-term services and supports. And we also conducted 2 public forums in Jacksonville, Florida, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and a series of 4 focus groups with employers, people with disabilities, and disability specialists. The issue briefs, and I encourage people to go look up this report. I'm glad to provide the link. I think it is, talk about hucksterism. Of course, I had a major hand in this thing, but I think it is a valuable compendium. In particular, the issue briefs present a total of 31 corporate best practices and 50 promising public policies and initiatives for employment of people with disabilities. Some of the corporate best practices include at IBM and Microsoft, they have centralized accommodations funds in companies so that any costs of accommodations do not fall on local department budgets, And that, when that happens, it, you know, helps overcome manager resistance to accommodations. I don't want this accommodation cost coming out of my budget. Companies like Hewlett-Packard, Merrill Lynch, and IBM do targeted recruiting, going to universities and institutes to find well-qualified people with disabilities. Companies like General Motors and American Airlines work to change corporate culture by encouraging disability affinity groups for people with disabilities. Companies like Giant Eagle and Microsoft train all employees in disability awareness and sensitivity when you come in the door. Those are just a few of the best practices we found, and I anticipate that labor shortages will cause more firms to adopt policies like these. So what's the bottom line? The report presents a fairly sobering picture of the barriers that people with disabilities still face in finding and keeping jobs, particularly with regard to healthcare, transportation, and corporate cultures. But I was also pleased to see the large number of policies and other facilitators that hold great promise for opening up employment opportunities. I was struck by the number of cases we found in which employers report very positive experiences in employing people with disabilities, often as a result of using the best practices. My favorite quote, the NCD wanted us to collect a bunch of quotes, not just statistics, a bunch of quotes. So I took off my economist hat and went out on the web and talked to all the people on the Business Advisory Committee and got some nice quotes. My favorite quote was from a Pillsbury executive. He said that people with disabilities tend to be very good in creative and innovative workplace environments, since they have to be creative in coping with everyday disability-related problems. It really rang true for me. I feel like my own creativity has at least doubled since I've been in a wheelchair. I also really like the quote from an IBM executive who said that IBM has a policy of accommodating every employee, whether they have a disability or not. It's just sound business practice to make sure every employee is as productive as he or she can be. You know, accommodation should be the rule for all employees, not just the exception. And that really ties into what Kai was talking about, that hopefully, you know, we're seeing transformation or reconceptualization of what it means to have a decent job, to change the background norm here, that to extend the idea of universal design from a physical environment to a organizational environment that says jobs should be flexible for everyone, and when they are flexible for everyone, accommodations for people with disabilities don't stand out. A lot of companies have bureaucratic norms where accommodations really stand out, or you're getting special treatment. Well, if you have an if you have an environment where accommodations are the norm, then people with disabilities will fit much more easily into that culture.
Thank you very much. Professor Cruz. We now have time for questions.
Andy Levy. This is really for Kai, and I know Dan will have a comment probably on this. This is a case that has not been mentioned today, but I think cuts across several of the panels has been the Buchanan case and the issue of attorney's fees. And I know not many people really, that's a subject dear to the heart certainly of lawyers and maybe no one else. But I do suggest that the difficulty in attracting members of the private bar to bringing these cases and quite a few of the other problems that we've identified have been from the fact that the private attorney general aspect of the ADA and the Fair Housing Act has really had its water cut off. And I just would be interested in, Kai, whether there's been any attention given to that in the Restoration Act and your efforts, and any other comments you'd have.
Okay, so for those folks for whom Buchanan just, for some reason, doesn't slip off your tongue, it's one of actually a series of Supreme Court cases where attorney's fees were really pulled back for folks. So in this particular one, if you ended up getting a settlement, you know, then you were not considered to have prevailed because, right, but that was the Buchanan, yes, yep. Exactly, and then because there were others on contingent fees. So there has been an effort starting from about 3 years ago to overturn Buchanan as well as a bunch of other cases. So, and that was from the civil rights community. they've never been able to get a Republican, you know, really on the bill, and therefore it hasn't moved very far. They did actually just introduce it finally about 2 months ago, you know, to and I'm pretty sure that they fixed Buchanan in that. I know they fixed a bunch of other pieces. But I do not think that we will ever get something like that through and made law unless we engage in our own interactive process with the defendants, you know, to say, okay, what are your issues? What are your problems? Let's sort of figure out whether there's something that we think is going on that shouldn't be going on for you, and then you give us something. I mean, that's the way the political game works. And it's a very dicey situation because people don't usually like to talk across, you know, especially in this area. But this has come up for me because of an ADA Restoration Act. As I said, I believe we have to have a very strong, you know, regarded as prong that just shows the minute you show a nexus between the impairment and the adverse action, whatever it is, that's it, you're covered. Now, that means everybody, you know, for the employers to buy that is a hard thing because it means that everyone potentially can bring a case. You know, no matter how many times I say back to them, well, anyone can bring a case right now under Title VII. They can argue they were fired because they were white, black, Hispanic, you know. But I actually think we're making some progress on this, though. But one of the things that they come back on is, well, these various frivolous lawsuits. And what I say in response to that is this bill, the ADA Restoration Act, is not the place to have this conversation. Because the fact that this is an issue you have, that goes across any civil rights laws. And if you want to talk about issues with lawsuits, I have something I want to talk about too, which is attorney's fees, right? So my argument back to them is not, I don't hear you, you're wrong, you're crazy. It's, you know what? Fine, that's something we should talk about. That's not this bill, but that is something that we should then move to. So that's where I'm at. It's you know, why I stay optimistic in life generally, because otherwise how the hell do you do this work, you know? And I'm also optimistic about the long term, you know, and, you know, so.
Who is this? Who has a question?
I do.
And who is I?
Who's I? Sorry about that.
Your name.
This is Kathy Hagen from Minnesota.
Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Maurer.
Hi.
Actually, I have a comment first, and it's for Kai Feldblum, which is basically that I've heard you speak many times now over the years, both in disability rights and in gay rights action, and your speeches always are like, you know, like the shaving commercials you used to have where they had the bracing shaving cream, you know? That they're always very energizing, and I very much appreciate the fact that you're still out there pushing for us here. My question to you, though, is about the Restoration Act, and I've heard various pros and cons of the language that is being used. Do you think there's at all a chance that it will pass? Well, I mean, let's put it this way. Given that even if it passed, you know, the president would veto it and we'd have to go back through that. Is there any chance that at all that it would pass this year? And if not, would any new administration that was at all more liberal
sane.
Or something, yes?
Sane, I think.
Sane, okay. I'll say that. Would we have a better chance at that, or are there still too many things to be worked out in the immediate future for that to happen?
Okay, and, you know, and Andy Imperato is sitting here. You'll hear from him in the next panel, and he, as well as a number of others, have been very, very active. You know, we've been working in the last few months. I actually think that there is at least a good chance that we get this bill passed. In fact, even this year. Now, that's not a guarantee. I'm just saying that the work that's been done. But I actually, in answering to that question, Kathy, I want to go back to where Doug ended in terms of the accommodation, just to sort of capture the piece in terms of the scope of the definition. Yes, it would be great if every employee was accommodated, right? Yes, it would be great if every customer got sort of what they needed in order to enjoy the goods and services. The fact is, I believe we do need a reasonable accommodation component or a provision of auxiliary aids and services component that is part of a non-discrimination law, you know, and that is targeted to a certain group because I don't see them spending the money otherwise. Okay, so whatever passes has got to ensure that that component stays strong. Now, it might be, though, that for some other components, like work scheduling, we do actually want it more universal and less targeted. Now, I can tell you right now, I would not write a bill in which you, like, pull out work scheduling. It's just a bad idea. But I'm just telling you that conceptually, that's what's sort of in my head. So I would say that we have very strong champions on in Congress. I mean, Steny Hoyer has taken this on as his thing again. Unbelievable, you know, and he's the majority leader. He's got a lot of things on his plate, and he has made this a priority. We are working very hard to try to come to an agreement with the business community so that, in fact, it could go through the House and the Senate and be signed by the president. And when the lead negotiator for the business folks said at one of our meetings, we've had five now, and in like meeting number three, he said, so why are you guys negotiating with us anyway? I mean, next year you'll have a probably a Democratic president. And Andy Imperato said back, and it was such a great answer. He said, well, number one, we'd like to have a bill that's going to work for everyone. I mean, we want people to be hired, right? We're fine about having a conversation so long as we're having a reasonable conversation. And the second thing is there are lots of other things we want to fix in the ADA besides the definition of disability. So we'd like to get this one out, and then we can go back to including some pieces around attorney's fees and other pieces. So, you know, I stay optimistic, you know, but that's because it's Friday at 2 p.m. So, you know, and yesterday at 3 p.m., you know, was a harder moment. So we'll see.
No damages, no attorney's fees, except for the outrage of it. What is the incentive to take these cases?
Well, there are damages in the employment arena, and most times what happens in Title III, and Daniel can talk to this, you've got damages often in state laws. And so they combine a state law claim and an ADA claim. But let me tell you, in terms of damages, I can assure you that anytime anyone ever says the word notification to me, I say, oh, yeah, notification. Now, of course, you mean, of course, that we'll be putting damages in, right? Because, you know, so.
And even if there are damages, then a lot of times the award of damages is what you might call sort of minimum. One of the things that needs to be done, it seems to me, is to find a way to demonstrate that the taking of liberty and property that sometimes occurs with respect to disability is a thing of sufficient importance to justify some amount beyond what the minimalists sometimes offer. Disability, they think, well, yeah, but we let you in, sort of, so why are you complaining? Do you have any plans for that, any of you?
Well, actually, I'm going to have a question for Daniel that's sort of off of this. So, but in other words, what you're asking is how do we change culturally?
Exactly. Sort of,
yeah. Well, you know, I think Daniel is correct in terms of saying don't look at this in terms of, again, the sort of special rights. It's about, it's to my piece of, we are all part of a community. We are all members of this society. So, you know, it shouldn't be any sort of grace that someone gets to come in to some place or use some goods or services. Instead, it's if those goods and services are not fully accessible, that's some lack on the part of the person offering. I mean, it's just a sort of a shift in terms of the cultural understanding. But I'd actually be interested in both the economic view and the litigation view.
Well, I think from the litigation point of view, we have to be careful. California has the dream law for us. It's got not just damages, but presumed minimum damages of $4,000 per violation for UNRU Act and $1,000 per violation for the Disabled Persons Act. And so doesn't that seem wonderful? And then that starts being rather economically ruinous for some folks. So what happens? Well, some courts start saying, well, under the UNRU Act, it has to be an intentional violation for there to be money damages. And so then you start seeing when there are folks like, what's his name, Hubbard, who filed, you know, 500 of these cases at a time, that the law of standing gets narrowed and narrowed and narrowed. So they're saying, well, but, you know, Hubbard's plaintiff in this one lives 5 miles away, and there's a closer Circle K, so he doesn't really have standing. He's not going to go to the Circle K that's 5 miles away. And you get bad distortions in the law of standing, just the way the Fourth Amendment got rewritten once there were a lot of drug cases. And it's the point, really, Dr. Maurer, that you talked about to some degree when you were saying that eventually the judges will keep using the language of integration, but they'll start ruling the other way. So I think, yes, we need damages. I'm certainly not disinclined to use the UNRU Act and Disabled Persons Act in the right places, and Target's a great example of that. And to actually a better example, because it's a complete example, is the phenomenal job that Amy Robertson and Tim Fox did getting a $13 million settlement out of Kmart at a time when Kmart was emerging from bankruptcy. That was an amazing use of the UNRU Act. And I think they're about to do the same thing to Taco Bell. But so there are places to use this, but we're going to have to be careful, or what's going to happen is, I'm not smart enough to know the answer. You know, right now in Maryland, nobody is going to sue about a restaurant with a few steps, no matter how badly Andy might like to go to the restaurant, because they'll fix it while the suit's going on, and then you don't get any fees under Buchanan, so you've wasted your time. At the other end, a gazillion suits are getting filed in Florida for each one of these restaurants, but with demand letters that say, pay us $5,000 and we'll go away, and the judges don't like that, and properly so. I'm not smart enough to know the answer to avoid those twin shoals.
This is Laura Rothstein. Do you have time for a question?
Fast. Yes.
I love the strategic thought and that all three of you are given to this. I hope that there are people that are looking. You're primarily focusing on Title I, but I hope there are people looking at Title III as closely to look on the standing issue. And I think one of the issues that needs some attention on this is the website issue, because yes, a big corporate website needs to be accessible. There's no excuse for it, just like a big chain store needs to be accessible. But what are you going to require of the small web provider in terms of what their requirements are? And this is where I think bringing everyone to the table at the outset, one of the best things that happened after the Air Carrier Access Act was passed is they brought to the table small airlines, large airlines, pilots, attendants, HIV, people with mental illness, people with mobility impairments. The whole group was there and that drafted the regulations that were responded to. This is what I think we're in need of right now looking prospectively at where we might go with the ADA.
Sorry.
Well, I was going to say that. I mean, definitely, in terms of the ADA Restoration Act, it does apply to all of the titles, and so it is definitely something we've been thinking about in terms of application. But I also think it's incredibly important to pick up, and Laura, it's part of what you were saying this morning, about the different avenues of achieving the end result. So if the end result is a cultural change, litigation is only one piece, and certainly damages in litigation is one piece, as opposed to if you start thinking about some incentivizing and education. And, you know, law can be used in lots of different ways. And I think we need to be strategic and creative in that broad range.
I just want to say, Laura, on the small website thing, Brown, Goldstein, Levy has a website. We are a small firm. The website is accessible. It didn't cost us particularly much to make it accessible, and there's nothing we wanted to do that we had to change or constrain because of that. that's actually an area, the website area, I think is the easiest one from an economic point of view. It's one where the educational cultural component is still so huge, where a target's lawyer could get up in front of Judge Patel and saying, and he clearly thought himself the standard and the reasonable man standard, and said, you know, Judge, before this lawsuit, I didn't know blind people used computers. And that clearly in his mind justified and excused. That's a bigger problem for us there than the economics.
This Mark?
Yes, you are?
Mark Reichert, American Foundation for the Blind. Thanks. I want to publicly acknowledge and thank the National Federation of the Blind and Dan, you especially, for your work working with us and other organizations on advocacy before the Federal Communications Commission on mobile phone accessibility. So thank you very, very much for that.
We're going to win that one too.
Great. This question's for all three of you, but especially from the advocacy, Dan, your point of view, and the economist's point of view. Mm-hmm. I think this issue about making the case about market share is absolutely an important one. It's one that certainly those of us who play around in this public policy area like to try to use. Can you talk a little bit about how refined we need to be with data in connection with making that argument? You know, I think it's an excellent argument in principle. I think often so much the data doesn't exist, or at least it's not as rich or robust as we would like it to be, to really hammer that point home. But perhaps I'm wrong about that. I would just be interested in your thoughts about that.
You're absolutely right. You know, when I was growing up in the 60s, the bad guys kept winning the arguments because the good guys came in and said, we're civil rights lawyers, we're on the side of the angels, so we win, right? And we have to not just believe in our arguments, we need to make them. It seems to me that, for example, going back to the example of Kindle, the data can be found. There's a National Library Service research study that showed that blind people read, I think it's 5 times as many books every month as sighted people do. And so you can talk about quintupling the market share when you're talking to somebody who's talking about e-books or accessible books. And you can go and you can find out from audible.com how big did their revenues jump when they made their website accessible to blind people so blind people could get books from audible.com. So there are ways to go and make that argument. And part of that means in terms of the culture shift, just as, you know, the NFB spends a lot of time teaching blind kids they really are competent, we have to believe in our arguments and go out and find the data as we would in any other kind of case.
Questions?
Mention briefly, you're right, there's a real data problem there that most companies don't know how many people with disabilities are in their consumer base. They will know, I'm sure, the percent of women, percent of people over 50, and all of that kind of stuff, but don't know the percent of people with disabilities. We did, and part of that, of course, goes to the thorny issue of how you measure disability, which I've been involved with in the helping the Bureau of Labor Statistics design some questions that will go on the monthly employment survey, so that hopefully later this year the federal government will start reporting on a monthly basis the employment status of people with disabilities. They're getting the questions finalized and hopefully put on later this year. We did, in doing this National Council on Disability report, found a number of cases and talked to a number of companies who did say that one of the big benefits they found from forming disability affinity groups and, you know, making strong efforts to involve people with disabilities in key jobs was that in many of these cases, the employees with disabilities came up with great ideas for consumer products. You know, here's a different way of fashioning this. They were a great source of innovation. Well, like that quote from the Pillsbury executive, that people with disabilities in a number of these companies, anecdotal reports that they came up with some great ideas for products that went on to be big with consumers. And of course, you know, a lot of the products that we have now, the remote control that everybody uses, it's a staple of Stapled Homes was developed for people who were mobility impaired. So I think there are a number of companies recognize this, and they recognize that, yes, there are a lot of people with disabilities in their consumer base, but there just isn't sufficient data on that yet.
I just want to add one thing, that I think it's useful to segment different things that we're trying to achieve, because some of it we can achieve with just enough data and a desire. And then other things, data and desire is may not be enough. So and another project I run called Workplace Flexibility 2010, where we're trying by the year 2010 to have consensus-based ideas from both employers and employees to make the workplace more flexible. I heard this thing called the 80-20 rule, which I had not heard before. I don't know if other people have. You'll see. This is from this woman who had been in Marriott for many, many years, and she had put out a report to show that flexible work arrangements, based on the studies, made employees more productive. It was better for retention. You know, so that was the argument that employers should, on their own, as good business practice, right, do flexible work arrangements. Well, actually, the data is a little, it's not so clear that it's just the flexible work arrangements that's doing this. Plus, we define in my project flexibility as also including paid short-term time off and paid extended time off, which they were not looking at in this report. So she was very nervous that we were like mudding her report. And she said to me, Chai, don't you know there's the 80-20 rule in the business? So basically, if you get it, they're 80%, then that's it. Then they go the rest of the way. You see what I mean? Like, they don't need the 100%. The data is totally, you know. Now, they'll do that. They'll use that 80-20 rule if they otherwise want to achieve that result. Because let me tell you, if they don't, suddenly that missing 20 will be, you know, that's all you hear about. So I do think it's about the combination of arguing that there is some utility to diversity, there is some utility to the outreach, and then the splash of data, you know. And as opposed to some areas where that's not going to work, and that's when you actually need the strongest stick of the law. But my sense is that we have so often just gone to the strongest stick of the law as our default, and what we need to do is start segmenting more carefully. What do we need the sharp stick of the law, heavy hand of the law, and what do we want as a more cooperative, involved, you know, data plus a little effort?
What do you say we take one more and then break?
Bob Dinnerstein. And
Bob?
Bob Dinnerstein. And
yeah, Bob.
Since I have the mic, I guess it's me. One of the things that I'm really interested on the looking at the entire work environment and getting not just the employer but other employees to be sensitized to issues of disability, and it's because of this. I think one of the problems we have is that we've really, despite the existence of the social model, we really privatize disability. And even when we look at it in employment, we think of it as something that is between the employee and the employer. And indeed, we have privacy and other restrictions which require that. But the problem is that other employees are not often part of that picture in terms of adjustments that they might be willing to make. So, for example, if we think of the cases that look at seniority systems that are where people are bumping up against them for reassignment, what if other workers thought, well, you know, seniority matters to us, it's very important, but we would be willing to think about an exception to seniority if it was actually an accommodation for people with disabilities. So I'm wondering whether anyone knows, either in a unionized or non-unionized workplace, whether any of those kind of conversations are going on, because I worry that to the extent the issues have come up as either or with respect to so-called innocent non-disabled employees, we lose in those cases.
I can tell you that from the union perspective, they are not at all thinking that if you say it's because of disability, then their seniority things should be changed, right? I mean, that they really do see that as quite sacrosanct. But I think going to sort of the more underlying piece of your question, if this is correct, I think you are very much correct that we need to engage the workplace in a more holistic manner to say, and you've sort of heard this before, but how do we make this work for everybody? So I might need this accommodation because of my disability, and you might need something because you've got an aging mother, and you might need something because you've got a kid, and you, okay? So at least this is what we have found in terms of the flexible work arrangements, that often if you do things in a more team approach, you can get something's done better. Now, sometimes laws can stand in the way of that because they're trying to, you know, they were passed for one reason and now it's going to be undermining that effort. And we still have prejudice, hello, out there. So, you know, they might decide I just don't want someone, you know, with this medical condition. So, but I actually think that is the way to go, acknowledging some of the issues of prejudice and, you know, addressing those. I actually think that some team approaches just make sense to me.
Let me just mention that what you say about co-worker attitudes is certainly important, and there's, again, not much data on that. There are some psychological experiments showing that people express some prejudice, reluctance to work with people with disabilities, especially, it turns out, if they're going to be in a team-based bonus system. They're worried that the person with a disability are going to drag down their bonus. So that's some of the attitudes that have to be overcome. There's not a lot of good data on this. I should mention that another research project involved in, and Peter Blank is also involved with this, is a study of disability and corporate culture, where we're working with, this is funded on a grant from Office of Disability Employment Policy, where we're working with a number of large companies to do intensive case studies of companies, their corporate culture, with employee surveys and surveying not just employees with disabilities but their coworkers and managers, to try to establish a good sound case study methodology for looking at the role of attitudes and corporate policies and practices more generally. So I hope we have a better answer to this in a year.
In terms of where we have to go and culture, and this is a down note on which to break, but might as well deal with reality. We got a call, I guess it was about 18 months ago, maybe 24 months ago, from an insurance defense lawyer in western Pennsylvania. He had just lost a case in which he was defending the grocery store. What happened was the shopper came along, and at the end of the aisle, bag boy, who was blind, was heading towards the bathroom, and she tripped over the tip of his cane, and she sued on the theory that it was negligent for the employer to allow the blind bag boy to go to and from his place of work to the bathroom unaccompanied. And the judge submitted the case on that basis, and the jury returned a verdict for the plaintiff on that basis. The good news is it's the first time we ever wrote an amicus on a motion for new trial, but it seemed worth the effort, and it did get thrown out. But we've still got a ways to go in terms of the attitudinal issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, just that don't end completely on the down note, okay? Just can't let you guys go on your break on that, okay? I just want to say that I think it was 2 weeks ago I spoke at the National Association of Law Placement, which is the main group doing placement, right, of lawyers. These are all like the managing partners and EEO folks from the law firms. They had their first plenary session on, they decided to do disability and sexual orientation and gender identity. So, of course, you know, they came to me. This is my two areas, right? But what was amazing was that with both of these areas, there is a sense of discomfort. Certainly in terms of gender identity, a sense of how do we have these conversations, you know? And it was a phenomenal session. It was just me with this partner, you know, sort of having a conversation. And I was just able to get across such amount of information and a sense of possibility, you know, that not to be scared, not, you know. So absolutely, we have both of those stories going on right now, and that's why we're all here, to keep working. So,
well, now, but blind people do get a chance to participate in the workplace, even in Pennsylvania, right, Dan?
This week.
Yeah. I think that there are certainly lots of misunderstandings, but I think we're further along than we were. So let's break for 15 minutes. There will be cookies available for those who didn't get enough lunch, and there's plenty of coffee. So we'll come back in 15 minutes. Luann says there are announcements.
Hello. I have certificates of attendance for William Richardson and Eve Hill. If you want to meet me in the hallway outside the auditorium, Also, we have copies of Blind Justice, Dr. Tenbrook's biography, and The Man and the Movement available for sale on a table to the right of the registration area during break. Thank you.
Hey there. Well, I have to say,